This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
I'm Deborah Tannen, known for the book You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation, in which I've just been talking to my great delight on the show Living Dialogues. Duncan Campbell has just been a terrific conversationalist, and I've been so grateful for the opportunity to enjoy Living Dialogues. It's a privilege.
I can't thank you enough. I've had a lot of interviews, but this has been very special.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Deborah. From time immemorial, beginning with indigenous councils and ancient wisdom traditions, through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a dia flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in Living Dialogues. Welcome to Living Dialogues. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, and I'm delighted to have as my guest, Deborah Tannen, someone whose work I've been familiar with for many years, particularly when I first came across it was when she wrote her international bestseller, You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation. Deborah Tannen has written a number of best-selling books since then. She is a member of the linguistics faculty at Georgetown University, where she is one of only two in the College of Arts and Sciences who hold the distinguished rank of university professor. As mentioned, her book, You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation, has sold more than 2 million copies and has been translated into 29 languages. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 3 years, including 8 months as number one. It was also on bestseller lists in Brazil, Canada, England, Germany, Holland, and Hong Kong. This is the book that brought gender differences in communication style to the forefront of public awareness. Among her other books, Talking from 9 to 5, Women and Men at Work, was another New York Times business bestseller. The Argument Culture, Stopping America's War of Words, won the Common Ground Book Award. And I Only Say This Because I Love You, Talking to Your Parents, Partners, Sibs, and Kids When You're All Adults, won a Books for Better Life Award. You're Wearing That, her book about conversations between mothers and daughters, is her 20th book. She's a frequent guest on television and radio. She's an internationally recognized scholar who has received numerous awards. She holds a PhD from the University of California in Berkeley, as well as 5 honorary doctorates. She was a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences in Stanford, following a term in residence at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey. And in addition to her linguistic research and writing, Deborah Tannen has published poetry, short stories, and personal essays, as well as 2 plays. Her website is www.deborahtannen.com. That's Deborah Tannen, TANNEN.com. So, Deborah, what a real pleasure to have you here on the program.
I'm so glad to be here, and thank you for that lovely introduction.
You know, Deborah, you really made a big difference in my life. I've, for many years, been a great proponent, really ever since I can remember, of the bringing together of understanding and co-creative union between men and women. And I remember way back in 1962 when I was a freshman in college and Betty Friedan's book came out. And I was so excited by it that I bought several paperback copies with what little money I had at the time and gave it to every woman that I went out with. Because I could see that even in the elite colleges, you know, a lot of these very bright and terrific women were spending the weekends, say, let's practicing their dance steps in order to sort of make a connection with a guy at a mixer or at a weekend party or something like that. And the roles were so clearly defined in the 50s that there was just that beginnings of a sense of real partnership that was opening up with Betty Friedan's book. And then we went through a long period where that, in a sense, got co-opted by tremendous misunderstanding and polarization. And I thought that your book, just showing the way that men and women are socialized differently as they grow up, they have different play patterns, they have different ways that they use language, was a tremendous breakthrough in enabling men and women who good-heartedly wanted to connect in some larger masculine-feminine sacred marriage kind of way, to really see that a lot of their misunderstandings were rooted in their different use of language. And something as simple as a woman getting very irritated when the husband won't ask for directions and they keep driving around, within a half an hour of the place they're supposed to be at and never getting there because he feels that his independence is threatened in his enculturated pattern if he has to ask for directions. And yet the woman has no problem with that and, in fact, welcomes the possibility of talking to a stranger, making a new connection. And something as simple as that, you know, with these age-old conundrums that we're all familiar with, were really, I thought, very deeply illuminated by your work and all the way through your other work, where you show that the yearning we all have for communication is sometimes unconsciously sabotaged just because we don't quite get the meta message or the matrix of how we are using language, which, to our surprise, the other may not only not understand, but misinterpret it in completely the opposite way.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think you put it so well. I've been told, what about when people don't mean well? And I often point out, mine is a rhetoric of good intentions. Mm-hmm. We know that sometimes people don't mean well, but that doesn't account for all the frustrations. And my approach to women and men grew directly out of my training in linguistics and my work, which began comparing New York and California. And it just is kind of helpful to people to see that something that they thought was happening only to them is happening to other people. And I'm not surprised and amused that you mentioned the directions, because that was such a classic example of where, when I put that example in You Just Don't Understand, I didn't realize myself how widespread it was. It was a single example that a single person had told me, and I could make sense of it in terms of the framework that I had developed. And lo and behold, it turns out people all over the country were suffering the same thing. You know, I sometimes say I didn't know there was a direction-asking crisis, but I guess there was. And sometimes that's just seeing that things that you thought were happening only to you are happening to other people as well is so meaningful to people.
And these patterns are universal. That's the other interesting thing, is I'll bet that directions problem exists in many, many different cultures, and some cultures perhaps not, but I would say probably most. And the key to it that you illuminated is that when young boys are playing, they're more action-oriented. They tend to do things together. They play sports together. And particularly if you're playing sports, the question of hierarchy arises. You know, who's the team captain? Who's the one that's, the point guard that's directing the basketball game? Who's the quarterback on the football team? You know, there has to be some kind of hierarchy of tasks. So even as you have teamwork, people are assigned, in a sense, to do certain things according to their perceived abilities. And when there's no coach there to make the decision, your peer group has to decide, well, who's going to get the most popular position in the outfield or in the infield or whatever. So young boys grow up using language, as you put it, for verbal display, to sort of toot their own horn in a way, to show their skill so that they can negotiate status. And when you see young girls play, they're much more conciliatory. They're much more, setting up who's going to, be the doctor, who's going to be the baby. They'll use logic and reason to say, well, it's actually more interesting to be the baby. You know, why don't you be the baby? And they're using words in a way to promote connection and cohesion and persuasion rather than direct command or hierarchical status. And that has an enormous influence on how women and men understand language and use it in their adult lives. And so hence we get to that direction problem, and the man would feel it somehow unmanly if he couldn't figure out how to get from point A to point B on his own, looking at the map, using his sense of direction, and feels that he would be beholden to a stranger and one down in the hierarchy to receive information from someone else and show his weakness. Whereas in his world of status, if you give information, you're one up in the hierarchy, and if you receive it, you're one down. Whereas a woman has no problem with that whatsoever. In fact, it's quite different.
You know, yeah, you're summarizing it so well. But I do want to say, in the credit where it's due department, the work on kids was done by anthropologists, sociologists, other researchers. Marjorie Harness Goodwin is a major one. And I was the one who sort of extended that to adult conversations, and it was mind-boggling, really, how much frustration could be explained that way. Otherwise, you know how you're reacting, and when the person you love is reacting a different way, you think there's something wrong with them. Although secretly, you may be thinking there's actually something wrong with you. But this, and I want to stress too, I mean, we're all concerned with hierarchy and who's up, who's down, and we're all concerned with making connections. But it's a difference in what you're focusing on in any given interaction. And so just embroidering a little more on the directions thing, a lot of men said to me, you know, it's really not that. It's just that if I stop and ask somebody, he's probably not going to know either, but he won't admit it, so he'll send me on a wild goose chase.
Exactly.
I'd rather be lost because of my own ignorance. And they also have said, you know, you learn a lot driving around a neighborhood, and there's some truth to that, too. But it struck me that I have never been told by a woman, well, if you ask somebody they don't know, they won't admit it. Because there, too, you're making an assumption about people not wanting to talk in a way that puts them in a one-down position. And that assumption explains so many other interactions. So, for example, a woman who wrote to me that when she was in medical school, and this went back to where she was the only woman in her class, she had gotten a low rating evaluation, and she thought that was unfair, and she asked the supervising physician why he rated her that way, and he said, well, you don't know as much as the others. And she asked, well, how did you draw that conclusion? And he said, well, you asked so many questions. And she was absolutely certain that it wasn't that she knew less, but it was that when she didn't know something, she asked, because she wasn't thinking, if I ask, will this make me look bad? And her colleagues, the guys in the program, were aware of that and were not asking. And I don't think it's clear that it's always better to ask or always better not to ask. I mean, I guess if you're the patient, you would rather that the resident ask if he or she is not sure what dosage to give you, for example. But there are situations where maybe it would be better to go find it on your own. People have said to me, well, I don't want my subordinates to be asking me. I want them to find out. But the pattern is just so widespread. I mean, people have found that in classrooms as well, that girls apparently are more likely to ask a question that will show they don't know. And whereas young men are more likely to try to find it another way, because just that awareness of not wanting to talk in a way that will compromise your position.
And there are many other subtleties to these pattern recognitions that you have made, and I think it's good that we have the opportunity here in this program to talk about them, and yet recognize that there are these generalized patterns which do generally hold true, even though there are many nuances, as you've just suggested. And I think the other thing we want to keep in mind is that a masculine bias or a feminine bias is best when they're combined in a kind of balance. And one of the reasons for reading your books and benefiting from them, in my own case and in my own view, and why I recommend them to everybody I know, is that basically it allows you to, in a sense, learn another language so that you can be inside the perspective of another culture that you want to be in intimate harmony with. And so just like it's interesting if a person knows another language, you know, if you speak English as your primary language and you go to France and you learn French, as I did, or if you go to Spain or Mexico or elsewhere and you learn Spanish, you realize that you're in a different mindset. You're in a different aspect of your own psyche when you're speaking this other language. It has a different kind of humor. It has a different kind of sense of irony. And as you enter into it, not only is it extremely gratifying to find another part of your psyche activated by speaking and thinking in this other language, but you develop a deep appreciation for the gift of that particular culture to the international polyglot world that we live in. And so already it gives you an opportunity to expand your horizons and deepen your compassion as well as your understanding. And I think you're suggesting, I think, quite outrageously and absolutely accurately that men and women who speak the same language of English, let's say, or French or whatever it might be, are nonetheless using language in such a different way that at times they really are speaking masculine speak or feminine speak. And if you don't see that, and if you don't understand those nuances, you can easily be caught in unwitting and unfortunate misunderstandings. And so one of the great examples for me was when you talked about the breakfast situation where the man comes down to breakfast and he's about to go to work and he's about to go into, let's say in this model, the competitive status hierarchy that he's working in. And the woman, let's say, is going to be staying home that day. And he asks her a question. He said, is there anything we need to talk about this morning, honey? Who's going to pick up our daughter at 4 o'clock? Okay, you're going to do it. Anything else we need to talk about? And she said, no, we're all set. And so he turns his attention to the daily paper and he buries his face in the paper as he's drinking his coffee and eating his breakfast. And the paper goes up as a barrier between the two of them. And then she asks him a question, which seems to be completely out of the blue to interrupt his focus on reading the paper, which makes him quite irritated. And he said, well, I thought we already talked about that. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. And this gets repeated so that it's almost a caricature. And by the time that he leaves for work, he can't understand why he was interrupted 3 or 4 times when he thought he'd been so clear. And what you're saying is that one way of looking at this patterning is that underneath it all, when he goes to work, even if he doesn't consciously understand this, if he's around the water cooler at 10:15 and a coworker, especially a male one, says, hey, how about that baseball game last night? Wasn't that amazing? And if he hasn't read about the baseball game, he gets put in the situation of information receiver. But if he's read about it and then say, yeah, and did you notice in the box score, showing that he'd actually read it very closely, he again gets one up. And this may seem frivolous, but yet it's sort of ingrained in the social patterning of information exchange, whereas the woman has really very little interest in these kind of public displays of sports or politics relative to the masculine and is interested actually in making sure she's shored up or amplified their connection before he leaves. So as he's buried, behind the paper, she'll ask him 2 or 3 questions, which may be unnecessary from the information point of view, but from her point of view, she's trying to reaffirm that connection before they're going to be separated for the rest of the day. And he doesn't understand that and feels irritated and intruded upon. And she feels basically cut off and abandoned in an extreme caricature way of saying this. But yet there's such profound truth in that. I think many of us have experienced that. And until I read your book, it never occurred to me that those meta messages were really what was underneath that kind of miscommunication.
You know, thank you so much for putting it that way. And I have to say, you just taught me something. You know, I've been talking about this male-female thing since 1990 when that book came out. The perspective in which I would have talked about it is, first of all, I would talk probably more about the end-of-the-day conversation. You know, how was your day? Where she'll say, you know, what she did and what she thought and who she met and what they said and what that made her think. And then turn to him and say, how was your day? And he'll say, same old rat race. Okay, nothing special. And then they might go out with another couple or two, and suddenly he's regaling the audience with something that happened at work. And she feels, how come you didn't tell me? You know, what am I, chopped liver? And and he's thinking, gee, I don't know, I just didn't think about it before. And it's exactly what you're saying there, that the sense of using talk as a form of display where you get the respect you deserve, do your part in a public talking situation, whereas for many women, talk is the glue that holds a relationship together. So when a woman complains we don't communicate and the guy says we have our communication is fine, and they're thinking of a different type of communication in terms of just being close for him, we can read the paper, we're sitting together, so that's, you know, we're together, and for many women, you have to be talking about something, and not that it's necessarily important, but what's important is that you that you're talking and that you kind of let the other one know what's going on in their life. So I do give the breakfast newspaper example, and interesting, I have to say, you know, when I wrote that book, I put great effort into understanding and representing fairly men's point of view, even though that was really the result of research, because I started out understanding the women's point of view. So I would have talked about it in terms of he doesn't feel the need for the kind of talk she does, but I don't think I put together that he needs to read the paper so that he can hold his end of the sports conversation with the guy. So you really taught me something there. And I think this would be a good time for me, too, to say we're going to be talking about women and men, and just always say that I'm very aware, as I'm sure many of your listeners are, that nothing is true of everybody. I mean, if we're not talking about 100% versus 0%. And I often say about the directions thing, my husband does stop and ask directions, and I'm the one who says, no, no, dear, I can find it on the map. And so there always are exceptions. But knowing that there's a pattern is just as important if you don't fit the pattern as if you do, because people will be expecting you to, and you'll be getting a very different response if you're a woman or a man talking in ways that are expected of the other members of the other gender. It's important to keep in mind that not everybody fits this pattern, but important to understand the pattern even if you don't fit it.
Exactly. And because the main thing is what we're interested in is deep communication and eliminating unnecessary misunderstanding. And I have a similar situation in my own marriage where I'm usually the one who's easy about asking directions, and my wife tends to not want to do that, wants to sort of find her way on her own. And so although she may be inhabiting the so-called masculine pattern and I'm inhabiting the so-called feminine, the fact that we know that they are patterns helps us not get into argumentation over the fact that we do it differently. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I think when we're talking about masculine and feminine patterns, if we have this added dimension that you've just mentioned of understanding that everybody is a mixture, everybody's unique, but the main thing is to be alert to when misunderstandings and miscommunications are happening because you and the person you're talking to do things differently. If you know these patterns, it can, you know, have the light bulb go off and you can say, oh, I see. I don't know why they're resisting asking for directions. And then you may say, okay, fine, let's just go ahead a little bit and I won't bother to ask for directions, or vice versa.
And but it might not be a deep-seated psychological problem.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Often we're in
just
our
a style.
We're quite inclined to think of things in terms of unconscious or underlying psychological motives, and that's very helpful. It's good to know that that can be the case, but it's also sometimes good to think of these conversational style differences as the first line of defense before we start accusing each other of having underlying pathology.
Yes, and I often say we have a tendency to pathologize in our culture if there's right. difference, rather than to try to understand it or illuminate it, or as Jean Houston would say, to mythologize it. That one way of using the word myth is as pattern recognition of human behavior. And so rather than seeing our points of difference necessarily as I'm right and I'm healthy and you're wrong and you're pathological, you know, we can expand our own understanding of human nature and use our goodwill and good-heartedness to actually reach a higher communication and teach each other things, as we're doing in this very conversation, you know, inspired by even the third part of the stool here in this dialogue, which is the awareness we have that there is a good-hearted, deep listening, attentive audience that's holding the space, you might say, for the vocalization that's going back and forth between yourself and myself. You know, if we felt that people out there were completely closed and not interested in this, then what would be the point of you writing your book, of me talking about it, and so on? And so it's always coming from that point of curiosity and willingness to open to another's point of view, I think, that we're wanting to cultivate.
An example I like of how people are willing to change if they understand, one of the things that I found and wrote about women and men was that when girls talk, they tend to, and this is true of every age, little ones, adults, they tend to face each other. Mm-hmm. And keep that kind of anchoring gaze on each other's faces as they talk. And it's very common to see little boys, older boys, and men talking, really listening to each other, but as sitting at angles or even side by side and looking around. And it's a very common frustration. Women will complain, men don't listen, and sometimes it's true. But quite a few women have told me, you know, I know he's not listening, and he'll say, okay, so I'll ask him, you know, what did I say? He'll say, I'm listening, and I'll say, well, what did I say? And he can tell me, but I don't get it because I know he wasn't listening. And sometimes it can be traced to the fact that he wasn't looking at her, and her not, it doesn't occur to us that maybe you could be listening and not looking, and it doesn't occur to him that she expects him to look. A student of mine commented that she had this running frustration with her boyfriend that when she would say, "No, I want to talk to you about something," he would lie down on the floor, close his eyes, and put his arm over his eyes. And she could see clear as day that he was going to sleep. And he would say, "No, no, I'm listening." And she'd say, "You're not." You know, they never could clarify it. And then having been in my class and looked at the videos that I had and thinking about it this way, she realized suddenly, yeah, it made sense when he said, "I'm listening even though I'm closing my eyes." So they talked about it, and she said, "Now I get it, so I'm not going to pressure you." And then the next time, you know, they're going to have a talk, he started to lie down, and then he sat up, and he looked at her. And she said, you know, "Gee, to what do I owe this?" And he said, "Well, now that I understand why it means something to you, I'm going to try to do it." And I don't think I would guarantee that that's always the case, but I think it can be the case far more than we think. You know, if you just say to somebody, "Do this because I want you to," the feeling is, you know, if I change it, I'm admitting that I did something wrong, and you're right. But if we understand that this is just a difference, and now I get it why you want to talk that way, then it is almost automatic sometimes to accommodate. You know, another similar example, a man who told me that his wife would come home from work and complain about work. And he thought, on the one hand, first of all, he'd say, "If you hate your job so much, why don't you quit?" And she said, "Well, I don't know, I like my job. I don't know what you're talking about." And then the other thing that he really felt it was wrong. She was gossiping, and that was wrong. And just kind of coming to understand that talking about what's going on at work, and especially troubles talk, talking about troubles, is a way that part of this kind of using talk to connect, that for many women is just the way you use language in a relationship. And he gave it up. He just gave up the idea that what she was doing was wrong, and he started to listen. And this is really cracks me up. He said, "And now she's reading maps." And I said, "Now what is, wait a minute, I lost something here. What does that have to do with reading maps?" And apparently this was something that he had really wanted her to do, and simply because she felt that he was now making an effort to accommodate to what she wanted, she made that effort to accommodate to what he wanted.
Amazing, isn't it? I mean, how something that simple can remain so obscure for so many years and then have the light of pattern recognition put on it. And you describe this sometimes in your book as asymmetries between different ways of communicating, where what we've just been talking about, say the masculine, is often comfortable in the role of giving information and help, but not in receiving it. And the woman, or the feminine, is comfortable both receiving help and giving it. So when women are engaging in, as you say, troubles talk, you know, "Oh, I've got this problem," or "This happened to me today that didn't meet my expectations," or whatever, they're very comfortable in talking about it. And the man thinks that if something is presented like that, he needs to fix it. And so he immediately moves out of empathy and just listening into trying to fix it. And the women can sometimes get irritated by that because they're really not looking for somebody to fix it. They're just, you know, finding a way of staying in connection. But if we move to the next level, the women are also more, I would say, ready to accept help and even ask for it, or to admit mistakes, than the masculine, because of this bias and emphasis in the masculine world on status and hierarchy and independence, and the bias in the feminine world of creating connection and maintaining it in accommodating and compromising and seeing the other's point of view and so on. And in traditional indigenous world, they describe these two perspectives as the hoop and the tree, where the hoop is the ground, the foundation in which the tree sprouts, and it's really the matrix culture. It's the family, it's the keeping the connection in the community, and the tree is the directional element that masculine conversation or activity can take. You know, as we see the arrow coming out of the circle to designate masculine, and then the cross underneath the circle to designate feminine. So the feminine sort of holding the matrix, the space in which some kind of directionality can happen. And one of the things that we see when this is not in balance is that the masculine is just incapable of admitting a mistake at a time when it's crucial that it does so. And you have a quite remarkable story as we come to the end of this dialogue in your book, You Just Don't Understand, entitled The View from a Different Mountain, from a story by Alice Madison called The Colorful Alphabet, where a man named Joseph invites another man, Gordon, to visit his family in the country because Gordon's wife has just left him, and during the visit they all climb a mountain. Do you want to tell that story, or shall I just summarize it?
Yeah, I love it. And Alice Madison is one of my favorite writers. But just briefly, Gordon, they've climbed to the top of the mountain and then climbed on their way. And on the way back, Gordon thinks that he left his backpack on the top, and her husband goes running back up to the top, comes back without it, and it turns out he knew it wasn't there, but he didn't want to look. He didn't want to admit that he had possibly. No, now that I realize that I'm telling it, I think I may be forgetting a detail. So, what was that detail about that he didn't want to admit?
The detail was that he had actually seen the backpack of his friend on somebody else's shoulder, bringing it down the other way. And so when Gordon said, gee, my backpack, I left it, one of my favorite ones on the top of the mountain, he knows already, incredibly, that it's not there. But rather than admit that he's already seen it on somebody else's shoulder and saying, I made a mistake in not calling that to your attention, he actually not only climbs the mountain himself, but tries to get his wife, who's exhausted, to join him in this fruitless effort without telling her why he's going through this amazing charade.
And I think he says at the end, he says it's a big deal, and she says, admitting a mistake was not a big deal to me. Climbing the mountain a second time would be a much bigger deal.
Exactly. So against the background of that story, of course, we can think of what's happening with our own administration at the moment.
Oh, goodness, yes.
It's just unbelievable when you see somebody so unwilling to admit a mistake that they will actually climb the mountain a second time, as it were, even if they suspect it might not work, just so that they can maintain their sense of independence and not admit a mistake. And this is what is so incredibly frustrating when that kind of thing happens at the meta level as well as the micro level of our personal relations.
Thank you for pointing out that parallel. I mean, that's so relevant. I do want to point out, too, we do talk about how women tend to focus on connection, where many men will focus on hierarchy. But it's important to keep in mind that we're both interested in both. And for those who are focusing on hierarchy, that it often is a way to create connection. So there might be this, in fact, I have a little videotape of kids where you really see this little boys, and, you know, they're talking about, ha-ha, they can hit a ball. You know, mine's up to here, mine's up to the sky, mine's up to heaven. And then the last one, mine's all the way up to God. So it's competitive, but you just see they're having so much fun. It is a way of connecting. And I think women can also be very competitive in their struggle for who's more closely connected. You know, who knows more details about the other's life. And the whole issue about the popular girls, it has a lot to do with hierarchy, but it's often negotiated through who's closer rather than who knows more. So it's, you really have both going on at the same time. I'd like to comment, too, on what you're bringing up, the issue of asymmetry, because I think that's so important.
Please do.
Yeah, good. Often, you know, I should say that some people feel that when I talk about differences between women and men as these different conversational styles, I'm giving insufficient attention to the power differences between us in our society, because certainly those are there. And I point out sometimes that these very conversational style differences in themselves can lead to asymmetries that result in a power difference or play into that. And here's an example, and it's connected to mothers, which is another reason it's kind of interesting to mention it now. Another sociolinguist, anthropological linguist, Eleanor Oakes, had a study of families talking. And one of the things she found out was something she described as father knows best. We often have a ritual. Families, American families, have a ritual. They come together at the end of the day over dinner, a kind of telling your day ritual. And she noticed that people in the family very often, the children will be, quote, problematized, where they will have a problem and the father will offer to solve it. And mothers were often problematized. So the mother has a problem and the father tries to solve it. And it was very unusual for the father to talk about a problem that the mother and children helped him solve. And all of this created a father knows best scenario where the father is kind of framed as the one who has the answers and the mother, like the kids, is framed as the one with all the problems. And Oakes points out, and her co-authors, that in a way the mother sets this up because she will often say, to the kids tell Daddy about what happened today, and she will often set herself up by telling about her problem. And I was pretty certain, she actually says in one article, perhaps inadvertently, she's setting the father up, and I believe it is inadvertently, and I'm quite certain that she is trying to create a kind of connection, that she, when she says to the kids, tell Daddy what happened, she's trying to draw him into the family unit in a way that she would want to be drawn into the family unit, because for girls and women, telling about the details of your day is the way that you create that sense of a friendship, that connection. But because it's much less common for boys and men to want to tell about their problems as a way to connect, he's assuming he's being asked to solve the problem. But it does create an asymmetry. So you're starting with a simply, you know, equally valid, different ways of creating connection, but you're ending up with an asymmetry where the woman has the problems and the man has the solutions. And that really can play into a true power difference.
Exactly.
It helps create it as well as reflect it.
Mm-hmm. It's very, very rich, this field that we're talking about. And I have to say, as we come to the end of our dialogue, Deborah, it's such a great pleasure to have this opportunity after all these years of admiring your work to have these dialogues and conversations with you. It's just a delight.
Well, thank you. And it's what a treat for me to have someone who's read this stuff and has such interesting thoughts on it. So thank you.
And also, we want to thank our listening audience for evoking this conversation in this segment of our dialogue together. I've been dialoguing with Deborah Tannen, internationally renowned author and scholar, author of You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation, and 19 other books, including another New York Times bestseller, The Argument Culture, Stopping America's War of Words. Be with us as we continue here on Living Dialogues. And visit us on my website, livingdialogues.com. That's living, DIALOGUES.com. And if you'd like to listen freely to additional archived visionary dialogues with myself and other transformational thinkers listed on my livingdialogues.com website, once you have entered your free subscription to the Living Dialogues podcast here on Personal Life Media, future Living Dialogues will automatically be downloaded to your computer on a weekly basis. Or simply browse through the list of programs here whenever you like, download them, or listen to them on your computer. Thanks again for your deep listening in evoking this program. All the very best. And stay tuned now after the music for some very interesting opportunities available to you as a listener to Living Dialogues.
Find more great shows like this on PersonalLifeMedia.com.